Good morning again. If you're visiting with us today, we're in the middle of a teaching series on the Sermon on the Mount. And this sermon is perhaps Jesus' most famous teaching. It records God's vision for how we are to live in the kingdom of heaven, which, by the way, Jesus is clear about that the kingdom of heaven is not simply some place we go when we die, but it is available to us now. It is near. It is at hand. We've already talked about the character of God's people and about how God works in us to produce that character. He works from the inside out. He changes our hearts and our motivations. Life in the kingdom of God is not simply about external behavior modification. It's about a true change, a heart change on the inside. And as we've discussed, that heart change then leads to a righteousness that exceeds anything that was being practiced by the religious establishment of the day, the scribes and Pharisees. And the irony there is that those people were the people who held themselves up as the models of righteous living. And so now we're getting into the details where the truth of what Jesus is saying is now being applied to very concrete situations. He's illustrating what he means when he says this is all about a righteousness that exceeds the scribes and Pharisees. Last week we talked about relationships. We talked about the need to be reconciled to one another. And this week, as you just heard, in the very vivid language in the reading, Jesus is teaching about lust, adultery, divorce, you know, really fun subjects, as well as being truthful. And I think that Jesus' placement of these subjects is really fascinating. You know, he talks about divorce in the middle of two much more fundamental issues that are actually related to divorce. And I want to quote from N.T. Wright. This is his commentary on Matthew. And by the way, if you ever want to get your hands on something that will help you in your Bible reading, get your hands on one of his commentaries. There, it's the whole New Testament. It's called For Everyone. And it's just, he just takes the scriptures bit by bit, passage by passage, and he writes basically a little devotional on each passage, kind of explaining the passage and all of that. And it's very simple and easy to follow along. So here's what he says about this. It may be stating the obvious to point out that if people knew how to control their bodily lusts on the one hand, verse 27 through 30, and were committed to complete integrity and truth-telling on the other, verses 33 through 37, there would be fewer, if any, divorces. Divorce normally happens when lust and lies have been allowed to grow up like weeds and choke the fragile and beautiful plant of marriage. That's why we're 87% full 4 weeks out, because he can write things like that, point out the obvious in very beautiful and powerful words. So, you know, we talk about the subject of marriage and divorce and sex. We generally do that about once a year. But how often do we actually preach sermons about being truthful? Which obviously is kind of the thing that undergirds all of that. It may sound a little bit less exciting, but I promise you it's just as challenging and just as important. So I'm going to really focus on the second half of the gospel reading, the part about letting our yes be yes and our no be no, because I realize I don't think I ever preached specifically on that idea. And the subject is truthfulness, being truthful, which is part of the larger whole of being a person who has integrity. Integrity, being a trustworthy person. And so we're going to do this under three headings, essentially. The principle of integrity, the practice of integrity, and then solving the problem of integrity. What is it? What does it look like? And then how do we do it? I want to go back to the reading. This is the last part of that reading again. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply, yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Like, you know, what Jesus has been teaching about anger and lust and adultery and so forth, he's dealing here with a characteristic of his culture. The "you have heard it said." That statement refers to several Old Testament laws that regulate the swearing of oaths, and in particular, oaths that invoke God's name. And so vows, just to be clear, in the scriptures, vows are regulated, but they are allowed. In fact, they are not in and of themselves the problem. Jesus even makes a statement on oath in Matthew's gospel, as Paul does on occasion in his letters. And God swears oaths throughout the Old Testament scriptures. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is Jesus is taking issue with an elaborate system of case law that had developed around this whole idea of making oaths. And the religious scholars, people like the scribes and Pharisees, they had developed teaching that if you did in fact lie or break an oath, the severity of your dishonesty depended upon the kind of vow that you actually took. And the closer your vow, the closer the vow that you took, the closer it got to invoking God's name or the temple or Jerusalem, the more seriously breaking the vow was taken. And so their use of very clever but also very unsound reasoning was taken to just preposterous, ridiculous heights. For example, one rabbi taught that if you swear by Jerusalem, you are not bound by your vow. So, I swear by Jerusalem, Mike. No, I was lying. But if you swear toward Jerusalem, then you're bound. You know, so it's this ridiculous irony that what was originally designed to encourage truthfulness, you know, oaths and then providing some regulations around those oaths, had degenerated into rules that essentially allowed you to lie. And so people would, you know, say all these ridiculous things to try and convince the other person that they were actually telling the truth. But in essence, they knew all along, well, I'm lying. They were telling people what they wanted to hear when they really didn't intend to follow through at all. And so Jesus just demolishes the argument at its foundation. It's ludicrous, you know, he says, to differentiate between heaven, the temple, or Jerusalem, or even from your own head. They're obviously not the same things, but God actually stands behind all of them, and everything, even your own hair, is present to God. Every time we speak, we're in his presence. Every time we speak, we're in God's presence, regardless of what kind of formula you might add to whatever you're saying. The point is, God's not stupid. He gets it. He understands what's going on. And so while we may play games with our words, it doesn't fool him or deceive him. He knows. I mean, to use a very harsh and vivid analogy, think, you know, Think of the person who's about to commit adultery, you know, taking off the wedding ring. Well, you know, well, I don't know who that's fooling, but it certainly isn't fooling God. He knows. In a word, the principle that underlies this whole subject is integrity. God is always present. So why lie? Why say one thing but do another? God sees it all. He cannot be deceived. You know, these the righteousness that exceeds the scribes and Pharisees, it's a righteousness that exceeds them both in its kind and its nature and in its degree. You know, if you're a Pharisee and you're living life trying to earn righteousness from the outside in, you're trying to change your life by living according to the law and keeping all of its commands, then the idea of God being everywhere and knowing everything is actually a crushing idea. It's frightening. It's terrifying. Because even if you have the will to try and be honest, to be truthful, you'll be driven by fear. You'll end up an embittered, angry, and self-obsessed person. And that's why the most religious people are oftentimes not very fun to be around. But if you're a disciple, someone who is saved by grace, someone who is righteous because God has declared it to be so, then God's presence, his awareness of what is going on in your life is not as fearful, at least not in the same way. Because we don't fear then condemnation. We don't fear being found out. Actually, what we fear is grieving God. We fear dishonoring someone that we love. But knowing that God is with us then, in that sense, is freeing. It fills us with joy, courage. Like David in the psalm we heard earlier, we set the Lord always before us. We call his presence to mind. We remember that he is right there. He's right by our side. He gives us strength, and we'll never be shaken. You know, that's kind of the principle of integrity. Jesus describes the practice in this whole arena in much simpler terms. He just says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. That's it. You don't have to try to, you shouldn't be in a situation where you have to try to trump up what you're saying, hype it up with a bunch of words to make people believe that what you're saying is actually true. You know, we're always speaking in God's presence. God doesn't live here at either end of the building. He doesn't live in here. He doesn't live down there. Guess where he lives? Where does he live? Where is the temple? You and me. So it doesn't matter where you are or what you say. He's there. He knows. Nick made this point. He said it's like, he's preaching down at the other end. He said, it's like every time we speak, there's a stack of Bibles under our hand. So what does it look like, this word integrity? You know, an integer is a number without a fractional or a decimal component. It's not split or divided. It's whole. So someone with integrity is whole. They're not divided in two or three different directions at once. What they are at home is the same as they are at work, is the same as they are at the gym, on the golf course, or out with friends. It doesn't matter. And so it's easy for us to think about integrity in those terms. You know, are we the same people here as we are out there? Do we change the way we talk, the way we treat others? You know, are we the same people online that we are in reality? George Bernard Shaw, he was a British intellectual, and he once said that life isn't about finding yourself. It's about creating yourself. He died in 1954, but can you imagine a better way to characterize the world that we live in? You know, we use technology, fashion, you name it, music, art, food, all those things we use as ways to brand ourselves, to create a persona that is oftentimes a bit dissimilar from who we really are. Integrity, in that way, is easy to understand, but I hope that you're beginning to also understand just how difficult it is to actually be that kind of person. You know, Jesus' call to just let your yes be yes, to eliminate untruthfulness in our lives, you know, is a little bit more challenging than just wishing it to be so. You know, when I look at myself, when I look at my relationships, I see that there are all kinds of lies that we tell. There are political lies, and I don't mean lies about politics, but kind of calculated dishonesty designed to further our own interests. You know, so we might misstate the truth to advance our own cause. There are more subtle things like lies of exaggeration. You know, we might say these kinds of lies often to a spouse or to children. Stuff like "you always" or "you never," right? There may be elements of truth in whatever we say that follows that, but because we have departed from reality with our exaggeration, we end up devaluing the other person's dignity. In a very similar kind of thing, there's what I would call lies of using words of inflation, hyperbole, hype. And this happens all the time. All the time. Dale Carnegie, in his famous book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, which, by the way, is actually a pretty good book, and he was influential around the same time as George Bernard Shaw. This book is really a very simple, straightforward book with a lot of good advice. But here's what he says is principle 11 for how to win people over to your way of thinking. He says, dramatize your ideas. This is the day of dramatization. Merely stating a truth, or what Jesus would say, letting your yes be yes, merely stating the truth isn't enough. The truth has to be made vivid, interesting, and dramatic. You have to use showmanship. The movies do it, television does it, and you will have to do it if you want attention. Again, using hyperbole, it may not just flat out be a lie, but if we are chronically just kind of hyping things up, it will produce cynicism in other people, I promise. You know, by every standard of measure that we have, our younger generations are far more cynical than the ones that have gone before. Why? Because they have to be. Because they live in a world that's nothing but a hype machine. And the only way you can defend yourself against it is to be cynical. Is to really just not believe any of it. You know, we think that we're so short-sighted. We think that the things that we are reaping today were seeds that we sowed yesterday. No, they were seeds that we heard it from George Bernard Shaw. We heard it from Dale Carnegie. These seeds were planted a long time ago. And now they're bearing fruit. So we tell all kinds of lies and misstatements. It's very common in our lives. One last thing about this practice of integrity. Jesus didn't offer this teaching on being truthful because it's convenient. I mean, it's not. I'm sure all of us can justify some of our duplicity as just simply, it's the cost of doing business, right? It's just the way the world works. And that's because it is. It is the way the world works. And I don't doubt for a second that there are times when lying actually can further our interests. But Jesus' teaching on the truth, that the truth doesn't stretch, is contrary. It's contrary to popular belief. Everything we say, every word we speak, is in God's presence. And we, as the people of God, claim to be those who follow the Lord, who himself says he is the truth. We say we are filled with the Spirit of truth. And so we need to be people of truth, whose yes means yes. The final point. So what do we do? How do we solve the problem of integrity? You know, and we say problem because this problem of dishonesty isn't just an occasional thing, as I mentioned. It's the way we live. So it's not simply enough to diagnose the problem. We have to ask the question, why? Why is this so difficult for us? Why is it so difficult? I think part of it is in this word, fulfill. In this text, Jesus says, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. That word fulfill is the same word that is often translated pay. Pay, like you're paying a debt. And I think that helps us to see something that's essential in this whole idea of truth, namely that the truth is costly. The truth requires payment. To tell the truth, you often have to pay a price. Ellis, after the first service, he gave me this. He said, when he was in seminary, at the library, at the seminary, over the library was this quote, seek the truth, come whence it may, cost what it will. You know, it gets at this whole idea. So imagine someone, for example, who craves approval. You can just imagine me, because I do. You know, that's a lot like I am. So why would a person like me be tempted to lie? Why would I be tempted to lie or to hype up the truth or whatever it may be? Often it's because I can't bear the cost of not being approved. Because it rattles my self-image. It makes me it's part of what makes me feel good in the world and secure and safe. And it's the same. It doesn't matter, you know, what you're trying to get out of it, whether it's control or security or whatever it is. And so I think in part the question of how to be truthful is a question of how can we feel secure enough, strong enough, established enough that we can tell the truth and pay the price that goes with it. We can tell the truth and absorb the cost. Another way to think of it is how can we be people who tell the truth as if we really don't have anything to hide? We need to remind ourselves that when Jesus called us, when he drew us to him and we put our faith and trust in him, he already knew us. He already knew everything there is to know about us. He already knew our sin, and he actually had already forgiven it. He'd already seen all of our wounds and scars, all the baggage that we're all carrying around. He'd already seen it all and actually made it his concern. And so there's no point in trying to lie. There's no point in trying to hide. He knows it all. And so all these games that we play to try and deceive one another, they don't work with him. He already knows it all. We are already completely revealed. Completely revealed to the one person who really matters. And that can be a terrifying thought until you know the rest. He knows everything, but the verdict is in. He loves us. He loves us. In fact, his love is so great for us that he gave himself up for us. We are loved. We are accepted. We are secure. And so we can stop hiding. We can stop lying. We can pay the price. We can absorb the cost because we are secure in him. Secure enough to pay the price of integrity. In the kingdom of heaven, the truth doesn't stretch. It doesn't stretch. It's not elastic. Let your yes be yes, and your no be no.